Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Here's one thing about that epic story called Money. It has a cast of millions. Banks, credit card companies, marketers, taxing authorities, police, even private eyes.
We uncover the data you need, the truth, without wasting time and money guessing what people are up to. Contact us today. Know the truth tomorrow.
As we've just seen, the economy is the ultimate exercise in collaboration. Collaborators you don't necessarily choose, such as Mother Nature, Enron traders, and governments who can impoverish you with the stroke of a pen.
The Zimbabwe dollar is virtually worthless because inflation has skyrocketed.
The hyperinflation in Venezuela this year is likely to run at a staggering 13,000%.
The peso has devalued 100% in the past year, and that has had huge consequences in the poor neighborhoods of Buenos Aires.
And then there are the rest of us, all of us, at constant peril of being drawn reluctantly into the story. We are promised privacy in many aspects of our lives, but in our financial transactions, as in an anxiety dream, we can find ourselves standing naked before the crowd.
The U.S. state of Massachusetts is suing Equifax. A recent cyber attack at the credit reporting agency exposed the personal information of 143 million people. That's about
If only there were a currency that was private, secure, stable, convenient, and not subject to the political or predatory manipulation of outsiders.
A Bitcoin, a virtual currency that doesn't abide by rules of a bank or government.
It's digital, it's filled with controversy, even if some businesses are using it and beginning to do so aggressively.
Bitcoin is the first of now a multitude of so-called cryptocurrencies, built not on gold reserves or limestone edifices, but on software code. The infrastructure is called the blockchain, a digital version of an old-fashioned ledger book. Just as those listed entry upon entry, sequentially numbered in indelible ink, the blockchain is an unerasable ledger of every private transaction. But instead of being held by some governing central authority, it is distributed peer-to-peer on countless computers across the world. So, people know Bitcoin as a digital currency, but it's really more like a digital yappy's stone, representing the community's collective memory. And in another throwback, the currency, in Bitcoin's case, consists of a finite number of virtual tokens digitally mined by e-prospectors. Thousands of computers churning in such places as Iceland and China, solving puzzles for which successful miners are rewarded with small purses of digital coins.
Every 10 minutes, they give somebody 25 Bitcoin.
Cryptocurrency pioneer Vinay Gupta is the CEO of Materium.
So there's a job that has to be done, taking all the transactions that have been done in the last 10 minutes and making sure that they don't contradict each other, and then publishing a block which contains all of those transactions to the entire world so that everybody can agree what the current bank balances are in the Bitcoin system. But the job is so profitable that there's very strong competition to get that job, and the one who has the fastest computer in that 10-minute block gets the 25 Bitcoin and the job.
Over time, 21 million bitcoins will be mined and no more. New York Times financial reporter Nathaniel Popper, author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money, says it's part of a utopian vision to protect the value of the money from incompetent, corrupt, or simply desperate governments.
This idea really harked back to the idea of the gold standard, which took a lot of power away from governments to issue as much currency as they wanted. Bitcoin provided this alternative of an asset that you could hold digitally without having to have it under your mattress, and that at least seemed to hold the promise that it would keep its value better than the peso or whatever local currency it was that was dwindling away.
It's an ingenious way to limit the money supply, but only one approach to digital money. At the moment, there are well over 2,000 cryptocurrencies, from number 2 Ethereum to Golem, Zipper, and hello Tinkerbell, Pixie Coin, each representing a different user need or economic ideology. Bitcoin constitutes about half the world's crypto value, but there are more than $80 billion worth of rival denominations, 15 of which are worth at least $1 billion. Neha Narula.
So holders of Bitcoin often feel like they're buying into this vision of a money that isn't controlled by government, that can't be inflated away, where no one can stop you from making payments and no one can take your wealth away from you. There's a cryptocurrency for pretty much any field or topic you could think of. There's DentaCoin, a cryptocurrency for dentists. There's Jesus Coin. There's an art project that came from someone who was a former student at MIT, Tetzel Coin, which is about sort of claiming your sins. You purchase this currency in order to absolve yourself of your sins. Basically, we're seeing all these different ways for people to buy into a future that they believe in by becoming a holder of this coin.
Every one of these currencies is differentiated by its philosophy of money.
Materium's Vinay Gupta, who previously coordinated the launch of Ethereum.
They take the philosophy of money, they implement it as code, and then they ship it to the world. And if people like it, they buy it. And if they don't, they ignore it.
So which belief system choice is correct? I don't know. Which religion is correct? Yes, the technology is mind-boggling across the board, but once again, like Mesopotamian temples or Tinkerbell, it comes down to faith. There are even schisms, like the one that split the Catholic and Orthodox churches. In the world of Bitcoin, they're called forks. Like when one part of the community chose to follow a new set of protocols, called Bitcoin Cash, and another stayed put. Likewise, there is Ethereum and Ethereum Classic. Bitcoin evangelist Andreas Antonopoulos.
Which fork to follow? Which is the chain that matters? Which one will keep its value? No one can tell you that. Because the only Bitcoin that matters is the one that you choose to validate. There is no objective truth. There is only empirical, subjective truth.
With apologies to René Magritte, put that in your "this is not a pipe" and smoke it. What all the sects, all the denominations, all the expressions of faith have in common is the desire for something utopian, an efficient monetary system free of interference, middlemen, and fraud, which forces us to look at the dystopian other side of the Bitcoin. For one thing, these currencies conceived for stability happen to be extremely volatile.
Bitcoin plunges on world markets, down more than 20% on Friday.
Tumbling below $10,000.
Falling below $9,000 for the first time
falling
since
Falling back
November.
Below $7,000.
Bitcoin has officially been in a correction for 190 days.
Bitcoin peaked at nearly $20,000 per coin last December. It's at about $6,400 now. Ethereum has tumbled from a January high of about $1,400 to $220. There is also the question of liquidity and frictionless e-commerce. A decade into crypto history, the process of purchasing and converting digital currency remains cumbersome. Too many steps, too few exchanges, too many delays. And for a currency that's created in part to stymie powerful intermediaries, too much trust to be placed in too many faceless actors. Then there is criminality. While digital currency is attractive to libertarians and anarchists and victims of hyperinflation, so far it has been most useful for the denizens of the dark web, where drugs and other contraband are peddled.
The man known as the Dread Pirate Roberts was sentenced to life in prison for running a $214 million online drug bazaar called Silk Road.
Silk Road was a black market website that allowed users to buy everything from cocaine to guns, all by anonymously using bitcoins.
Finally, there is that nagging question of state power. If nations lose the control of tracking and printing and, of course, taxing money, what's the glue holding them together? Anthems? Tourist attractions? Olympic teams? Vinay Gupta says the earliest crypto proponents, the so-called cypherpunks, thought government's time had passed.
And that's not inherently a crazy idea. I mean, the nation state as an institution is only a few hundred years old, goes back to the Treaty of Westphalia. Before that, we had this kind of feudal kingdom stuff. And before that, we had city states. And, You know, the systems that we use to run the world keep changing, dependent on the available technology.
Once again, economics professor Mark Blythe.
Number one, states are never going to give up voluntarily the best monopoly they ever discovered, which is the issuance of currency. Secondly, at the end of the day, if you have lots of different private monies to choose from and use, that depends upon the other people's willingness to accept and use them. So why does everybody accept and use the dollar? Because it's the largest economy. It's the biggest pile of cash in the world. It's the currency everyone wants to hold. Let's say that we do mark coins, right? I'm going to issue mark coins next week. How many people are going to want to hold mark coins? How am I going to do this intergenerationally? Am I going to live for 150 years? How am I going to redeem the promises?
But why rule out the possibility that a vast Bitcoin community or some other coin community could endure like any other, generation to generation? Blythe had an answer for that, too.
Let's think about the whole crypto thing. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, reading about this, and taking it very seriously. And I've come to the following conclusion. If you have to explain to someone it's money, it's not money.
That there is a good line, but Vinay Gupta has a comeback too, which is the inherent limitation of trying to explain a new thing in the terms of the thing it replaces. Cryptocurrency is like currency, Gupta says, about in the way a car is like a horseless carriage.
It has functions which are like money, but it isn't really money. It's something beyond money. It's more complex, it's more nuanced, it's more deft. It's more historical. So we're in this position where we're sort of confronted by something new, and we just find an old name and we apply it. Another good example of where this happened recently was the mobile phone. I'm old enough to remember when a phone was an electromechanical device that plugged into the wall, and you know, a few times a day it would make a loud ringing noise when an electrical signal came from an exchange and banged the striker on the bell. So we seamlessly went from the phone as this dumb device that was plugged into a wall to these very, very flexible and powerful pocket computers that we call mobile phones. It's not a phone. It's a pocket computer that happens to have an application on it that makes a phone call. Even the money isn't money. It keeps changing definition every few generations into something that has different problems from the previous problems. And we just call it the same stuff and we pretend it works the same way, even though it really doesn't.
This is the nature, I suppose, of an endless perplex. So, who's supposed to make sense of all of this, to define it, to mediate it?
Different people have managed to convince themselves that this thing is going to be worth something, that really is just an entry on a digital ledger somewhere.
Journalist Nathaniel Popper.
And yet, all of these people have come up with these different stories for why it should be worth something. When you meet people in China who are into this, you hear a different story than you hear from people in Argentina or from people in Finland or from people in the United States. You know, Bitcoin relies on storytelling around it and on the media because the media is the way these stories are propagated.
The media, because, as we said from the outset, money is a story we tell ourselves and stories are our racket. You can disintermediate the Federal Reserve, but for the time being, you cannot disintermediate the media. Once again, Neha Narula.
As I've been sort of studying and learning about money and Bitcoin and working in this field, I'm more and more convinced that it's almost entirely about perception. It's about the story.
Think about J.S.G. Boggs. He was an obscure conceptual artist until coverage of his British trial gave him notoriety worldwide. Suddenly, an original Boggs was a global asset. The old adage is, follow the money. The corollary is, follow the story. Which is exactly what renowned photographer and conceptual artist Kevin Abosh did. In 2015, a collector bought one of his portraits for a very large sum of money, inadvertently capturing the world's attention.
Abosh revealed this month that he sold a simple portrait of an organic Irish potato to a European businessman last year. The man reportedly paid 1 million euros for potato number 345, the equivalent of 1,080,000 American dollars.
A potato. The global incredulity was for him both fun and vaguely unsettling. Kevin Abosh.
You would hope that people concentrate on the artistic merit of the work that you produce.
But if the world was going to value him like a commodity, he wasn't going to be a mere spectator.
But I thought, well, if I'm going to be treated like a coin, I want to be the one who mints the coins.
Using the very blockchain technology that undergirds cryptocurrency, Abash e-minted 10 million tokens. He called them IAMA coins, each divisible to 18 decimal places. You can buy a token, or one infinitesimal fraction of it, and be in the possession of an original Abash. But more or less in the same way gold undergirded world currencies and computer-mined algorithms underlie Bitcoin, Abash connected IAMA coin to a physical asset, 100 prints of his blockchain address stamped on paper in his own blood.
So now I had this connection between the physical artwork, the blood prints, if you will, and the virtual artwork. My virtual artwork and a crypto token like Ether are identical, but it's like that Magritte, ceci n'est pas un pipe. It's like you're looking at a pipe, but it's saying it's not a pipe.
it's funny you should mention that. I've discussed that earlier in this episode with respect to maybe the progenitor of your art project, and that's Boggs, who was exploring some of the same issues. Are you, to phrase a coin, a crypto Boggs?
I'd actually forgotten about him. I'm surprised it hasn't actually come up in the last few months. But for sure, he addressed a lot of the same issues around value.
As previously noted, philosophers and economists, not to mention educational filmmakers, have been puzzling over these questions for millennia. So what can a couple of artists add to the discussion?
The crypto zeitgeist and the cryptocurrency phenomenon across the globe has people questioning value in a way that I think they haven't before. And I think it shouldn't be surprising that an artist could illuminate this in a way that greases the path for a discussion that pretty much anybody can get involved in. You asked about what is money, and I actually do have an answer. Money for me is energy. It's potential energy. And then I'd question, perhaps, is that energy just an extension of us? So are we actually separate from that which we call money?
Not you are what you eat, but you are what you fetch?
I'm looking at matters of identity, existence, value, human currency. It starts with identity. Where do I end? Where do you or the object in front of me begin, or vice versa? Are we one or are we separate? Existence. Am I? Are you? What are we? Value. How do we ascribe value to anything and everything, especially human life, or the moments, the seemingly fleeting, banal moments that together become the human experience?
And so, there you have it. What is money? It's what you pay the electric bill with. Oh, and it's also the story of humankind. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, and John Hanrahan. The heavy lifting for this special show was by Leah Feder. We had more help from Asta Chattaverde and Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
You're so money and you don't even know it.
That's what I keep trying to tell you. So money.
Could you not mess with me right now?
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.